Good Tuesday, July 22. I'm Phil Picardi. This is the NPR News Update. On the podcast, does the Independence Party Senate candidate help or hinder Al Franken's re-election chances? Child welfare is good in Minnesota, unless you're African American, and Duluth is a beer drinker's destination. First, Ramsey County Judge John Vandenorth has decided to allow a clergy abuse lawsuit filed against the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis and the Diocese of Winona to go forward on claims of negligence. The judge did leave a key question undecided, whether to allow a jury to decide if church leaders created a public nuisance by keeping information on abusive priests secret. But victims' attorney Jeff Anderson called the ruling a victory.
We now have passed the first hurdle and we're going to go to trial. And it's very clear that the judge gets it. And it's very clear that a jury's going to get it. And it's very clear that we're going to get another opportunity every day for the rest of these days forward to get more information out there to protect kids.
A lawyer for the Archdiocese, Tom Weiser, says he's hopeful the judge will throw out the public nuisance claim.
The majority of courts that have ruled on that have ruled that there's no legal basis for that claim to move forward. It certainly is our hope that when Judge Vandenorth has a chance to review the legal arguments that he will conclude the same thing.
The lawsuit has already led to the depositions of Archbishop John Nienstedt and other top officials. It's set for trial in late September. An attorney for a former Minnesota Gophers quarterback has asked a court to release the medical records of a Mankato man who was critically injured in May. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Former U of M quarterback Philip Nelson is charged with first-degree assault after a confrontation with former MSU Mankato football player Isaac Kolstad. Prosecutors say another man allegedly punched Kolstad and knocked him to the ground. Nelson is accused of then kicking Kolstad in the head while he was lying motionless. Nelson's attorney wants 11 CT scans taken of Kolstad after the incident. He says the scans are important to prepare his defense for Nelson. Prosecutors have said determining which injury caused Kolstad more brain damage will likely be key in this case. A Blue Earth County judge's order is expected this week. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
President Obama has issued a disaster declaration for parts of Minnesota damaged by flooding last month, but only 8 of 51 counties are on the list. Tim Pugmire has more.
DFL Governor Mark Dayton said it was his call to submit a partial request in order to get the federal money rolling to the state as quickly as possible. The list is expected to grow when the remaining counties complete damage assessments. A special session of the legislature might be needed to pay the state share of the disaster relief, but Dayton said he still doesn't know if or when that would happen.
I still haven't made a decision on that. Waiting until we have a sense of the full scope of the needs and what their timetable will be and when the FEMA money will get to them.
The damage amount is expected to exceed the money set aside in a new state fund, which was established to provide disaster relief without a special session. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Bain Belke, founder and artistic director of the Jungle Theater in Minneapolis, has announced his retirement. Here's Marianne Combs.
Bain Belke has been active in the Twin Cities theater scene for more than half a century, including 25 years at the helm of the Jungle Theater. He says he'll step down from his post at the end of next June.
I would hate to overstay my welcome, if you will, to get aged and not be able to do a good job. I just think it's wise to leave an organization when it's at an apex and it's healthy and strong, rather than to wait until things start to fall apart.
Belke, a native of War Road, made the announcement just 2 days before his 75th birthday. This fall, he'll star in the Jungle's production of On Golden Pond, beside longtime acting partner Wendy Lair. Marianne Combs, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Bob McNamara, who helped lead a charge to save men's gymnastics and golf at the University of Minnesota, has died at the age of 82. Peter Cox reports.
Bob McNamara was a football All-American and played basketball at the U of M in the 1950s. But it was McNamara's work in retirement that might have had the biggest impact on the university. McNamara helped raise funds for major athletic buildings like TCF Bank Stadium and supported the university's academics. Lou Nanny, who is heading up a $190 million athletic facilities fundraising campaign, says McNamara felt indebted to the U.
He just seemed to be a guy that was unobtrusive, came out of nowhere, never asked for anything, never expected anything, but always was at the forefront of getting something done when it came to the University of Minnesota and completely focused and dedicated to succeeding in the endeavors that he think were important for the U.
The university named the McNamara Academic Center in honor of Bob and his brother Richard Pinky McNamara, who passed away in 2011. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Emergency stomach surgery has temporarily knocked the Republican-endorsed candidate for governor off of the campaign trail. We go back to Tim Pugmire in St. Paul.
Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson is recovering at a hospital in Maple Grove after surgery to repair a small perforation in his stomach. Johnson made an early morning visit to urgent care, complaining of abdominal pain. Doctors then determined he needed surgery. Campaign advisor Greg Pepin said Johnson was still resting and he had not yet talked to him or his doctors. He said the pre-surgery indications were that it was nothing serious. Pepin said Johnson's public schedule will be impacted for at least a couple of days. He said the campaign will provide updates when more information is available. Johnson is running in a four-way primary contest on August 12th. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
MinSure's chief executive says he supports releasing next year's health insurance premiums early if the State Commerce Department and health plans agree. Some Republican lawmakers have accused Governor Mark Dayton of deliberately keeping the rates under wraps until after the election because they say health insurance costs will rise dramatically. Scott Leitz, the head of the state's online health insurance marketplace, says releasing rates before open enrollment begins November 15th would be a good idea.
We obviously understand the value here at MinSure of being able to shop as long as possible and get as much information around that.
The Commerce Department regulates health insurance plans. DFL Senator Al Franken will have a Republican opponent this fall, of course, but he'll also have an Independence Party candidate to deal with. Minnesota's third major party has not won a statewide election since Jesse Ventura did it in his gubernatorial victory in 1998. But IP candidates have drawn significant support and had a big impact on the outcome of statewide races. Could that happen again this year? Mark Zedeklik reports.
Meet Kevin Terrell, the 2014 Independence Party endorsed Senate candidate.
Government in America should be of the people, by the people, for the people. And what we're seeing is an awful lot of the government happening to the people.
Terrell is 50 years old. He's worked in military intelligence, and he's held several corporate management positions. He talks a lot about efficiency and accountability and doing the most with the least.
For me, it's not a question of bigger government or smaller government. It's a question of better government. How do we get value from government?
Terrell serves on his Lyndhurst Neighborhood Association board in Minneapolis, and he's organized several thousand people against airport noise. He says he has more government experience than Al Franken when he first ran for Senate, and more than businessman Mike McFadden, the likely Republican nominee. Terrell says he's the best choice to represent Minnesotans in the Senate because he is not tied to either of the two huge political parties and the special interests that fund them.
I want to connect Washington back to the people. The Beltway is an ever-growing moat, if you will, around Washington, D.C., that's separating Washington from the people. The only special interest I have is the people of Minnesota.
For now, Terrell's Southwest Minneapolis home also serves as his campaign headquarters. He's assembled a small staff.
Sean is our field manager, working to get people to parades, festival events, and those sorts of things.
And he's already airing radio ads at a couple of stations in the Twin Cities.
If you're tired of out-of-touch politicians who just vote the party line, then please check out my accountability plan at ktforthepeople.com.
The Independence Party attained major political party status in Minnesota following the 1994 election. Judging from several elections since then, it's unlikely Terrell will win his bid for Senate. But tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people may vote for him. In the 2008 Senate election, the recount concluded Al Franken had just 312 more votes than Senator Norm Coleman. More than 437,000 Minnesotans cast ballots for IP candidate Dean Barkley. That's more than 15% of those voting. Washington University political scientist Stephen Smith says in 2008, polls showed Coleman was losing far fewer supporters to Barkley than was Franken.
And so maybe Franken could have won that election with a sufficiently large amount to avoid the recount. But as it turns out, he won anyway. So Barkley probably didn't tip the balance.
A big question for 2014 is whether Terrell is more likely to attract voters who would typically support a Democrat, such as Al Franken, or those who lean Republican. Stephen Smith says some Republican-leaning voters may find Terrell's conservative talk about efficiency and accountability appealing, as well as his more liberal stance on social issues such as abortion and same-sex marriage.
So it could be that there will be people out there who are unhappy with the incumbent, Al Franken, who don't find the Republican candidate, especially on social issues, to be quite the alternative they want, and will end up casting votes for Terrell. But Terrell will have to be viewed by many of them as a reasonably viable alternative.
Even though he's only raised about $20,000 for his campaign, with half of it coming out of his own bank account, Terrell promises he'll be a viable alternative to Franken and whomever Republicans put up against him.
I think what you can see from us is a new level of strategy behind the scenes in terms of smarts on who we're going after and how. And using that to wisely target not only, obviously, voters, but money.
Terrell says he expects to spend less than $1 million on his Senate campaign. He's hoping the debates and the media attention they draw will help him gain attention, just as they have for other Independence Party candidates.
Mark Zedeklik on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Child welfare advocates say Minnesota's overall strong numbers for child well-being hide some real pockets of concern for children of color. The Kids Count data book, released today by the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, ranks the state fifth overall in the nation. But the report found the state also has some of the worst disparities in the nation, with almost half of Minnesota's black children living in poverty. Sasha Aslanian reports.
For more than a decade, Kids Count has ranked Minnesota in the top five states for overall child well-being. The annual snapshot compares data from every state, focusing on 16 indicators of economic well-being, education, health, family, and community. Minnesota ranked fourth for economic well-being, just behind neighboring North and South Dakota and Iowa. In health, Minnesota slipped a couple spots to 17, and in education, it moved up a spot to number six. Stephanie Hoganson, Research and Policy Director with the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, says many, but not all, of Minnesota's children are thriving.
So when we look at the numbers broken down by race and ethnicity, some of the educational outcomes, we know that children of color and American Indian children are less likely to be prepared for kindergarten and less likely to be enrolled in nursery school, preschool at age 3 to 5.
Hoganson says almost a third of second graders enrolled in public schools in Minnesota are children of color. So figuring out how to help children of all races succeed in Minnesota schools is a problem of growing urgency. Minneapolis's Northside Achievement Zone is a program that's working to address the kind of disparities flagged in the Kids Count report. At a summer school program at Plymouth Christian Youth Center, teacher Helen Fogg reads a book with kindergartners.
It's three letters, B-A-D. She feels
grumpy.
Bad. I feel grumpy and mean, so you're right. Bad, grumpy, mean, they all kind of mean the same thing.
By the time children are in fourth grade in Minnesota, 59% are not proficient in reading. Hoganson of the Children's Defense Fund says the numbers are more worrisome for kids of color. Nearly 80% of black and Hispanic children aren't hitting the fourth grade benchmark in reading.
They're hungry there.
8-year-old Elijah took a reading test at another NAS summer school site to track how he was doing.
All day long at night, it was cold and damp.
Last summer, NAS data showed a majority of kids like Elijah gained at least half a grade doing intensive work over the summer. NAS is in a high-poverty neighborhood and tries to help families tackle a range of issues, from employment to housing, that affect children's achievement. Hoganson from the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota says since 1990, the year of the first Kids Count data book, the number of children in Minnesota living in areas where more than 30% of residents live in poverty has doubled from 3% to 6%.
High poverty areas oftentimes are less safe. They have fewer resources like parks and tutoring programs. and it's more difficult to be able to play outside, higher pollution rates, as well as poorer performing schools.
Kids Count found the economic recovery has come more slowly for poor families. The 2012 data showed 15% of Minnesota children living in poverty, still several percentage points higher than it was in 2005. Sasha Eslanian, Minnesota Public Radio News.
From time to time, we like to check in with NPRNews.org digital editor Michael Olson. So let's do so again. Former Vikings punter Chris Cluey, Michael, is garnering a lot of attention on the website.
Yes, this is coming from, you know, after the Vikings released their internal audit, and essentially they, I guess you might, some would say artfully, turned it around on Chris Cluey, who was pushing to raise awareness about homophobic culture in the NFL. But then some of the comments came back that Cluey himself had made light about some sex abuse victims in the Penn State situation there in the Sandusky deal. And so this has kind of come back on him, where he was out there seen as a leader around the gay marriage amendment that passed in Minnesota. He was out there and a champion of this. And so there's a discussion, and actually Bob Collins from his Newscut blog started this. And it's a very, very heated discussion on our Facebook page right now. Some of the comments are upset that that we even published Bob's post, which said that Cluey is toast in this town.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's an opinion piece from Bob. And I think some folks read that as that was our news judgment on there. So that, of course, adds to some of the added discussion about where these things are coming from.
Mm. Yeah. So apparently Cluey said some things in his past that may be off color. And of course, he was going after the Vikings for their assistant coach, the special teams coach, Mike Prefer, who Cluey accused of saying some things about gays, especially when Cluey was outspoken about the campaign for that issue. And so, as you say, the Vikings maybe artfully turned around this whole thing, and now it's a question of he said versus he said.
Right, right, exactly. And Bob's post on it focused saying, you know, the biggest loser out of the Vikings' findings at this point is Chris Cluey.
Hmm. Interesting. Also on the website, nprnews.org, we're reading a story about the Bakken oil patch and whether or not that is sustainable going ahead.
Yeah, there was a fascinating look from 538, Nate Silver's outfit, at the sustainability of the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota. I added this on Minnesota Today. And essentially, you know, the kind of growth right now is unprecedented in the modern oil industry. And they're saying that it's also unsustainable, even if North Dakota continues its record pattern of exponential growth. The state would have to produce more than 400 million barrels of oil per month a decade from now.
Huh.
So that's huge. You know, the reserves are also massive up there, but this style of extraction is harder to predict how long the well is going to be good for, because you know it's this it uses more of the fracking approach, and so it's kind of, when you think about the older way that we would extract oil, the wells would be a little bit more reliable and predictable. And kind of the twist on this is that, well, you know, North Dakota is in this bind because it essentially needs to meet this exponential growth from a perspective of running the state. The state now has more than half of its tax revenue is coming from oil. So if you look at if that would collapse or there'd be a disruption there, it could have some significant ramifications for North Dakota.
Indeed. And finally, Michael, any idea if we're getting eyeballs in that big four chapter series that Madeleine Barron did on the Archdiocese and its problems?
Yeah. You know, it's a long story. It's a big story. And one thing that just from a social media perspective that I've seen with this story is that sometimes it might be confirming biases that some people already hold about the church. Mm. And so they might feel that they have read this before. You know, that's actually kind of part of the thread through it, that, yes, this has been a problem and we've dealt with it. And, you know, that's kind of part of the narrative that you read in there. But there's a lot of really deep and new information there. There's recordings that haven't been heard before of taped meetings. There's a treasure trove of stuff there. But it's funny when, you know, I spent a lot of my time crafting social media posts and short takes on these things, and sometimes getting people to really get the nuance of a massive piece like this is a challenge. But we're seeing that, you know, we're getting some more comments and discussion around the story. So it seems like it's being pretty well received. It's certainly a good bit of work from the a large part of the newsroom here.
Yeah. All right. Well, Michael Olson, digital editor for NPRnews.org and all things social media, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Nearly two decades ago, long before the current craft beer craze hit Minnesota, Fitker's Brewhouse opened in Duluth. At the time, one of only a handful of microbrewers in the state. Now, later this week, the company is opening its fifth pub and restaurant in Duluth. Its growth has contributed to the city's evolution toward what Mayor Don Ness calls the new Duluth, one defined more by arts, the outdoors, and yes, beer, than by the old days of mining and shipping. Dan Crocker reports.
The idea for Fitker's Brewhouse was first hatched over beer. Co-founders Rod Raymond and Tim Nelson and Tim's younger brother Brad were teammates on the University of Minnesota Duluth's cross-country ski team. They traveled out west to race, where the trio fell in love with the burgeoning micro-beer scene in towns like Bend, Oregon.
And it already involved all the people and the things that we loved, music and the outdoors, and at least in Bend and the places where that was already happening. You know, after a ski race weekend, it would be after party at the Deschutes Brewery.
That's Brad Nelson, who handles marketing for the Brewhouse's parent company, Just Take Action. And Tim Nelson recalls thinking, why not do this in Duluth?
We saw similarities in the towns and the cultures, at least amongst our friends.
The Nelsons, originally from Brainerd, are in their mid-40s now, bearded with shoulder-length hair and a passion for good beer and their adopted hometown. After Tim got his MBA, they leased a space that had sat empty for 10 years in the century-old Fitker's Brewery Complex and opened up in 1995.
What are you making today?
Just made French River Hefeweizen.
Brewer Shad Bagenstoss is just cleaning up after the last batch of the day. 3,000 barrels are brewed a year here now, but Tim Nelson says the scene they were so attracted to out west barely existed in Duluth when they opened. The original Fitkers had stopped brewing beer two decades earlier. A lot of people had never heard of craft beer, and there was only one venue where local musicians played original music. The Nelsons, who are also musicians, saw an opportunity.
We wanted places to play, and we just said, it was kind of more driven by that than, I mean, we wanted to do good, but it was kind of like we wanted to be a part of it. We wanted to build something that we could be a part of.
Nationally known acts like Low and Trampled by Turtles honed their skills on the Brewhouse stage. Soon, the homegrown music festival emerged. Meanwhile, Brad Nelson founded Duluth's first alternative paper, The Ripsaw, that chronicled the growing music and outdoors culture.
They were among the earliest promoters of what Duluth could be.
Duluth Mayor Don Ness.
Taking the attributes that had been kind of there, but always off to the sideline. Original live music or the outdoor recreation stuff, that was always kind of on the outside looking into how the city was identified. And I think over time, we started to build this stronger identity that focused on the things that they had been advocating for back in the 90s.
But it was a struggle for the Brewhouse initially, recalls Tim Nelson.
I made zero money for the first 3 years. I worked for free for Fitker's Brewhouse. The years 4 and 5, I took home $1,000 a month. And my mom and dad luckily paid for my housing and helped me with, you know, I could eat at the brewery.
And slowly, the business grew. A burrito shop and another bar followed the Brewhouse. In addition to supporting the local music scene, craft beer has also bankrolled historic preservation. In 2011, Just Take Action spent nearly $2.5 million rehabbing Duluth's historic City Hall into Tycoon's, another bar and restaurant. This week, they're opening a fifth business in a refurbished historic train depot. The company employs over 200 people and is approaching $10 million in annual sales. Joe Courtright, an economist in Portland, Oregon, who studies regional economies, says businesses like the Brewhouse are important because they can help attract other locally minded entrepreneurs.
I think we have some pretty good anecdotal evidence that the presence of microbreweries in particular neighborhoods and then in certain communities plays a really important role in triggering and then helping support revitalization.
Workers are putting the finishing touches on bar stools at the Brewpub's new Endian Station pub. But Tim Nelson says it will be the company's last expansion for a while. He says they'll enjoy what they've built and let other Duluth entrepreneurs take the lead in helping to shape the city. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
And that's the NPR News Update for Tuesday the 22nd. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for coming along. The Wednesday news right back here.